Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined, as always, by my colleague, Lahav Harkov. Lahav, I could hear your sigh of relief all the way from Modi'in to Jerusalem this morning when the government announced that there will not be a school strike and that our kids are going back to school. Exciting.
Yes. You know what? A former colleague of ours tweeted today, "I'm so sad that the strike is over and I won't get to enjoy more time with my children." And I was like, who are you? Like, I love time with my children for sure, but I also can't take, you know, endless time off from work. And it's just like extremely stressful balancing the two things.
Well, you maybe know, that tweet explains why that person might be a former colleague, but yeah, I love my kids too, but they got to go back to school. It's enough.
Right. It's enough. Just like, it's hard to come up with activities for them every day. Like, it's stressful. That tweet, I was just like, what is that?
You know that they're going to be off again in just a couple of weeks, right? So it's not like, you know, they start, like, I have a kid who's going into seventh grade. Okay. So she is like tomorrow school, right? She's only supposed to come at 3 till 5 tomorrow. It's like 2 hours. And it reminded me of like these kids when they start gone, like when they start nursery. So my brother has a child, a young, like 1-year-old. So he was saying, yeah, the first day you come, it's an hour and you have to be there with them. Next day you come, it's 2 hours and you have to be there with them. Only the third day, it's like 3 hours. They come a lot. It's like, you know, gradual thing. It's ridiculous. Yeah, and then they're off. And then they're off when it's Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, right? And then they're just off for like another 3 weeks.
So my son is 3, which means it's his first year in public preschool. And so he only has 2 hours tomorrow.
But 2 hours, right.
Part of it is just knowing what to expect. Like, I knew to expect that. You know, my husband and I figured it out. And now we know. And it's the same with the holidays. Like, I know the holidays are off. And I'm also off on the holidays. So that's fine, you know.
Right, but you're not off between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, right? Which now all kids are going to be off for.
Oh, are they?
I think so. Right? Wasn't that one of the agreements that there's going to be this, like they call it Gesher, a bridge between Yom Kippur and Sukkot?
Wasn't the whole point that the finance ministry trying to negotiate so that the school vacations would be more connected to normal, like working adults vacations?
You know what? For all I know,
this is
I got
the opposite of that.
For all I know, I got that part wrong. I can't even follow this stuff anymore.
I hope so.
Who knows what's going on? But at least they figured it out and they're going to go back to school, which is important. A lot of kids who are excited, beginning of first grade, you know, the beginning of a new milestone in life. And we all hope that our kids get a good education. I'm glad the country was able to figure it out. But let's also be honest, is that the teachers union knew how to take advantage of this situation, knowing that we're in an election. Yair Lapid, as the prime minister, does not want to see parents all upset and kids stuck at home, and everyone's going to be blaming him. Same about Viktor Lieberman as the finance minister, and they knew they could suck him for that. So, and they did,
for sure. But also, if you think that after this election anyone's going to try to improve that situation, the answer is probably no. I mean, basically, anyone who had any kind of platform or talking points about standing up to unions is either not really running anymore. That's maybe Abir Kara, who was like sort of the cut red tape czar of the last government. Or they're now merged into the party with Gantz, whose party was very pro-union. So, and those are people who say you were running with Gideon Saar, and then also like Matan Kahana, who, in the same party as Abir Kara, was in Bennett's party and is now running with Gantz. So I don't think that that's like even a voice we're going to hear. I mean, there are people like that in Likud, sort of, but it's like not their priority at this point.
By the way, talking about strikes, I read a story this morning in another newspaper about the strike that's going on still in the foreign ministry, right? And that Yair Lapid, who's going to be traveling to New York for the UN General Assembly, and hopefully you'll be joining him there, and covering that visit, had to hire a private production company to basically produce his visit. All the logistics, like, you know, you land at an airport, you have cars that pick you up, you get hotel reservations, you set up events and meetings and the room and all that stuff, is usually done by the foreign ministry. But the foreign ministry is on strike and won't provide that service to the prime minister, who also happens to serve simultaneously as the foreign minister. Right. So that strike continued. What are they striking about?
They have been striking sort of rolling strikes every time it's a different thing. It's really hard right now to get an Israeli passport. Like if you're an Israeli who lives abroad, just to give another example. And it's over salaries. They haven't gotten a raise in 10 years, maybe even a little bit more. And the last time that they negotiated for a raise, immediately after, the finance ministry cut some of their benefits, for example, free language lessons. So if they're expected to live in another country for 3 years, they should maybe learn the language before they go out. Or there used to be free private school tuition for the children, so that if they're in a place with a Jewish school, they could go to Jewish school. Or if they're in a place where there's no Jewish school, they could go to the quote unquote American school. And that was also cut. So, it's about that. And they were very optimistic about Lapid coming in, because Lapid talked about wanting to be a full-time foreign minister who was really focused on the job, which was sort of something that they had not had before. The irony, of course, is now there is no full-time foreign minister, but that's what he did for a year. So the workers were optimistic that he would hear their plight, and he didn't so much. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now.
And in the great advanced state of Israel, the prime minister needs a private production company to produce his visits overseas. Yeah. This is just, doesn't get better than this stuff. You can't make this stuff up, Lahav, And in the world of stuff that cannot be made up, there was an interesting incident this week with our famed, probably Israel's most famous spy, Jonathan Pollard.
On Tuesday morning, the Zionist Spirit Party, which is the party led by Ayala Chaked, posted a video online of Pollard saying basically that he supports Ayala Chaked. And he said, everybody makes mistakes. And referring to what he believes is a mistake is Chaked joining a government with left-wing parties and an Arab party, but that she's a patriot and she's tough and she's smart and that we should give her another chance. So then, and it was interesting. I mean, the man had not gotten involved in partisan politics in that way before in Israel, even though he was known to be right-wing.
Yeah, there were rumors that he was going to run at some point, right?
Well, so Itamar Ben-Gvir of the Otzma party approached him about running on his list, and he said no. And I know from a friend of Pollard that he did not want to do that. But it was interesting that he endorsed a different party than the one who had asked him to run for Knesset. He endorsed Chaked, and then the Likud universe, went apoplectic. They were just furious. You had Likud Knesset members basically calling him ungrateful. And he backtracked because he said that he thought that Chaked had promised not to join a government with left-wing parties again, which she had never promised that.
So he backtracked, pulled back. But where is Pollard today? People put up photos all the time of him around Jerusalem, roaming the streets, and I'm not sure what he does.
I'm not a close Pollard follower, I must say, right. But I think he lives in Jerusalem.
And I mean, what makes this interesting to me is there's always been this dissonance between the way Jonathan Pollard has been viewed here in Israel. Mm-hmm. I would say probably by the general consensus and most people, but particularly the Israeli right, compared to the way he's been viewed by Americans and even specifically American Jews, right? I mean, what Pollard did to a lot of American Jews who were working in government at the time, back in the 80s and even in the 90s, was create this cloud of suspicion over them of dual loyalty and allegiance, right? And people talk of how it stop their careers and constantly people were suspicious of them. And he first and foremost did betray his country, right? I mean, he did spy on the United States and he was convicted. I mean, I think we can all agree that he was sent to jail for an exaggerated amount of time maybe there was anti-Semitism that played in there. And that's why he had to serve 30 years in jail, which was terrible punishment.
And it just out of proportion
to what other people who were far worse as spies got. But on the other hand, in Israel, he was always this hero, Right. And even Ayala Chakade referred to him as this hero.
Definitely. I will say, I do think in the U.S. it is mixed. Like, I don't know, maybe because like I basically lived in a Orthodox, like a modern Orthodox bubble in the U.S. But like there were plenty of people in the U.S. who thought he was a hero, too, and a victim of anti-Semitism. It's not a, you know, I think in the U.S. it's mixed. Mm-hmm. And in Israel, like it was pretty, you know, like everyone thinks, if not that he's a hero, then everyone thinks that he was treated unfairly.
He was definitely treated unfairly. You know, remember, didn't Netanyahu go to the airport to greet him when he arrived?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Which was pretty...
It was like the middle of the night, too.
Pretty interesting. Netanyahu's in hot water, right, with the Meron Commission now.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think, you know, so just to our listeners, the Meron, the commission, the government state-appointed commission of inquiry that was set up to investigate the disaster in April 2021 when 45 people were trampled to death at the Lag BaOmer celebration on the Meron Mountain, sent out letters of warning to a number of top officials saying, we might find you responsible for this. And one of them was Netanyahu himself. Do you think this will impact the elections and have something to do with his potential return?
I don't think electorally it will impact the election. You know, like I don't think that like people are who were planning to vote for him are now not going to vote for him. But I think that there could be like a political pressure element to it. You know, like I think you had tweeted about this, right? That with Olmert, when he was blamed or very harshly criticized for this second Lebanon war, that was when the pressure began for him to resign. But I mean, at this point, I'm so like jaded about Likud in the sense that like, Bibi could do anything, you know, it's like, what was it like Donald Trump who said,
I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and they'll still vote for me or something. Right.
That's sort of how I feel like Likud is with Netanyahu right now, even though, you know, the corruption cases, some seem to have a lot less merit than maybe people thought in the first place. But either way, like this is serious and there could be charges coming forward from it or demands to resign and things like that. So it'll be interesting. It's sort of, I wouldn't say it came out of left field, but I don't think people were really expecting him to face this kind of, you know, what they call a warning letter from this committee. And I know Netanyahu wasn't expecting it either.
Yeah, he didn't seem to be expecting it in his appearance, though, before the committee was not particularly good, right? Remember, he went there and said, had I known, I would have prevented the disaster. Of course you would have prevented the disaster if you had known about it. I mean, everyone would have.
Right. The point is he's supposed to know about
it. Right. That's exactly the point. And there were multiple state comptroller reports. There were warnings. There were media reports. I mean, everyone kind of knew that this was happening. And he did the opposite. He pushed for it to be opened. So Haredim, so ultra-Orthodox Jews, because he was under pressure from the political parties to let them in. It's really a terrible case of how you know, religion mixed with politics and with terrible results and just a true tragedy that 45 people died and they didn't have to die, right? And that's what's, you know, it wasn't like in a war fighting for something. No, this was just the bad planning and people who were negligent. And my problem with it all is that no one's really paid the price. You know, not that I need to see that someone get punished, because no, I don't know that there is a punishment for the lives that have been lost, but the fact that there's so little accountability here is what's to me the most disturbing, right? Is that these 45 people are dead and everybody's still either in office, running for office, still in government. The police chief who was also got a letter said, I'm not resigning. I mean, how are you not resigning, right? You're the guy who you're totally responsible for this. How are you still digging your heels in after getting a letter from the commission? So it's there's some ridiculous reality here.
I agree. Like the police chief, especially, I mean, he had like a real direct responsibility. Some people, the justice minister was called in, right? And he was like a temporary justice minister for like a very short amount of time. So, okay. You know, but Netanyahu was there and he had gotten letters over the course of years. So I understand people saying that like he's not involved in such granular decisions, But for him to feign like total ignorance is not great. And the police chief, of course, is really directly involved. I mean, that's just, yeah. Right. I mean, but Israel just like doesn't have a culture of people resigning after they mess up.
No, they don't. Our entry this week is with Gil Troy, who's a distinguished professor from McGill University, is a weekly columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Center Field is the name of his column. I hope you all read it. I think Gil is a great writer, a very out-of-the-box thinker, and kind of middle of the ground. So I like him because he's not too far right, not too far left. He's center, just like the name of his column. And he's written a bunch of books about Zionism, Zionist ideas, why I'm a Zionist. And he just he's putting out a book soon, or maybe just did, with three volumes of Herzl's writing. And he was in Basel this week for the 125th anniversary of the first Zionist Congress. And before we get to Gil, Lahav, since when is 125 a big anniversary? That's like the thing that struck me. You know, I know 50, I know 100, I get 150. When did 125 become this thing that we, you know, celebrate?
Yeah, I found it pretty strange. You know, I guess it's good to celebrate. It's not bad, but it is weird that it's that number. It just seems very extravagant. I mean, Switzerland is not known for being a cheap country, and they invited like 1,400 people in. They're staying in fancy hotels. You know, they have a gala dinner, and, you know, all by a nonprofit, right? The World Zionist Organization, which I just wonder, like, is this what donors are donating their money for? You know, and I'm friends with the people who went. I've seen the pictures and the videos all over social media. So I guess it reverberated, and I guess that's their goal, sort of to get the word out there about Zionism, but I'm not entirely sure that this was the way that they had to do it. So it seemed very wasteful, even though it looked nice.
You know, on that point, I'll just say, I don't really care how people spend their money, right? As long as it's not my money that they're spending.
It's not private people. It's not private people. It's an organization, and it's considered an institute of the state of Israel.
Right, but they're raising money, and they're spending it the way they want. You know, I mean, whether it's the right way to spend it or not, that's not the issue that bothers me. I just think, to me, I mean, I hear that. I do hear your argument. But I also think that what's here is it's a bit of a disconnect. It's like, what does this have to do with the world today? And I mean, we get into that with Gil about how Zionism should still be relevant, how there's a narrative to tell. But it feels like people aren't thinking about this stuff, right? I don't know that this is how we're going to get people connected necessarily.
Yeah, I think if you want people to be connected to Israel and to Zionism, it has to feel a connection to their real lives. People who are not already connected, right? If you're like raised in it and you understand it your whole life, then that's different. But people who are not connected, they have to see a relevance to their lives. And I don't know that, you know, a conference in Basel is going to do it the way it did 125 years ago.
One thing that you and I did miss out by not being there is the famous photo, you know, which people probably do know, of Theodore Herzl leaning over the balcony over the Rhine River, right? Is that what it is? And everybody who was there got to take those pictures. So, you know, maybe one day we'll get there and get a photo on the balcony, Lahav.
I mean, yeah, I can't say with all of my cynicism and whatever about the money, I can't say I don't know that I would have said no if I had been invited. Oh, I mean, on. I probably would have said no because my kids were home. But otherwise.
But you would have taken the photo.
I would have taken the photo. That was pretty cool.
And you would have shared it on Twitter. So, you know.
Which is, I think, what they wanted.
Which is what honestly. They wanted.
I see a lot of like people like younger people. And younger activists. I mean, Gil said that maybe the social media was deceiving, that he didn't really see that many young people there. But from what I saw, it seemed to me that they were intentionally trying to find a lot of like younger activists or enough younger activists that would really make a big social media presence. And those people did a good job. I mean, they did what they were supposed to.
They influenced. The influencers influenced.
Right, the Zionist
influencers. Zionist influencers. Yeah, that sounds like theory. We just gave the anti-Semites their new campaign, right? Someone's going to write a manifesto against the Zionist influencers. Well, here is an interview with one of those Zionist influencers, Gil Troy. Here we go. It's great to have with us Gil Troy, who, in addition to being a weekly columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and we'd love to have him, is a distinguished scholar of North American history at McGill University. He is working now on a 3-volume series, books of Theodor Herzl's writings. His most recent book before that was co-authored with Natan Sharansky, Never Alone, Prison Politics and My People, a bunch of other books about American politics and different politicians. So Gil, it's great to have you with us. And you're just back from Basel, where the World Zionist Organization and a lot of Jews gathered to celebrate the 125th anniversary to the first Zionist Congress. And you actually, I think I saw somewhere on Twitter or Facebook, took a photo of on the famous balcony, like Herzl.
First of all, it's great to be with both of you, and thanks for the invitation. And you do such great work in setting a substantive, thoughtful conversation in the Jewish world, which is what we needed then, and Theodor Herzl sparked, and what we need now, and what you're helping to spark. So yeah, it was a very cool thing. I mean, it was a 2-day conference, Sunday, Monday, with over 1,200 people, including a big gala on Monday night when President Herzog came and spoke in the Stadt Casino. Now, it says casino, so you think that people were gambling, and in some ways, Theodor Herzl was betting on the Jewish future, but it's just a big fancy hall from in Basel. And so that was one of the great highlights, to kind of be in the very place where the formal Zionist Congress was launched. Of course, the Zionist idea goes all the way back to the origins of Judaism and Abraham and Sarah. And then yesterday, for those who wanted to, they arranged we could go to the Three Kings Hotel, which is still there, go through the Herzl Room. And I'm thrilled to say there are actually some copies of my latest book on Herzl by the bedside. There's a kind of etching of Theodor Herzl, and you're on that famous balcony. And they had a photographer. And they actually did it in color, but I, with my very limited internet skills, made it black and white because I thought that was more historic.
Well, it looks good.
It seems like everyone taking that picture. That's like the thing to do at this conference. And I know President Herzog took it as well.
Yeah.
And I saw again on social media mostly that there was another really fun sort of Herzl themed tinge to the part of the event, which is that there was an impersonator. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, in some ways, we're all Herzl impersonators, or at least we're, you know, bearing the Herzl torch. But the gala on Monday night, which was more crowded than the 2-day event, because many people from the Swiss Jewish community joined as well. And it was lovely to kind of have bonding there. So it started with, you know, cocktails, and then they had a show, and they actually were a number of very, very moving moments. They had the great granddaughter of Alfred Dreyfus, the French army captain who was falsely accused of treason, who was one of the causes of Theodor Herzl's decision to really come out strong for Zionism. And she actually just made Aliyah about a year and a half ago. And that was very, very moving to see her. And they did a kind of sound and light show telling the story of Israel and Zionism very quickly. And then Theodor Herzl showed up, you know, big black beard and a top hat. And unlike most of us, he was in white tie and tails. One of the amazing things about the Zionist Congress in 1897 was that the invitation formally said, you must come in white tie and tails. And then Theodor Herzl's good friend, Max Nordau, came dressed too informally. Theodor Herzl sent him away and had him come back into the tuxedo. The thing I love about that story is that Nordau had his tuxedo in his hotel room. Anyway, so there was this Herzl impersonator, but here was the cool thing. They asked questions about contemporary events, about technology, about Jewish unity, about the need to innovate. And he gave answers quoting Theodor Herzl. And I've just spent a lot of time on his actual writing, so I know they were quite accurate. Quoting Theodor Herzl, giving answers that were completely relevant to today. And that was sort of the great thing about the conference, that we were dancing back and forth between 1897 and 2022. And you know, we talked about challenges, we talked about problems, but we also were able to step back and go, wow, look how much we have changed. Look how much we have evolved. Look how much we have accomplished. Look how better off almost every single Jew, and certainly 98% of the Jews on the face of this earth are, thanks to Theodor Herzl and the vision of the Zionist Congress and the vision of the Zionist dream.
Gil, would Herzl, looking at the state of Israel today, as someone who really has an expertise in his writing, you wrote a book a number of years ago, Why I Am a Zionist, right? Looking at Israel and Jewish identity also. Would Herzl be happy with the state that is here today that we, the three of us, have the privilege of living in?
I think in many ways, yes. His second big book, The Altneuland, his novel, was a way of saying old new land. And every day in Israel, we go back and forth between the old and the new. We're a far more traditional society. We're a far more family-oriented society. We're a far more rooted society. We're a far more historical society than so many Western societies. But at the same time, we are startup nation, and we are living in not just the 21st century, but the 22nd century, which so many of our young people and so many of our smart people, unlike me, are helping to invent. I'm kind of stuck in the past. So I think, would he have certain criticisms? Yes. One of the really fun things about going through his diaries is it's kind of like the political science version of an artist's sketchbook. Every morning he wakes up and he's thinking of new ideas. What will this state look like? He's tinkering. So of course he would have criticisms. Of course he would have things that he would want to see better done. But on the whole, I think he'd be quite excited. But let's also talk about his great failure. His great failure was to think that once we have a Jewish state, once we have normalcy, it will be normal. And we're certainly not normal. That's actually one of our successes. And he himself understood that the power of liberal nationalism, the power of Zionism, was it always had to be volatile, it always had to be transformational, it always had to be aspirational. So when he talked about normal, he wasn't really talking about normalcy in the boring, likely Canadian sense. But what he was trying to say was anti-Semitism will disappear, and unfortunately, it hasn't.
So I've read Altneuland, and I wrote an article once comparing it to the artistic movement Afrofuturism, where African-Americans, seeing them, just for people, listeners who aren't familiar, see themselves as, you know, sort of an oppressed minority, and they envisioned a future for themselves. It also included like a lot of usually includes a lot of technological sort of advancements and things like that. It's like science fiction. And to me, in a way, Altneuland reads as science fiction, you know, when you read old science fiction and you think about what they see the future because of sort of certain things that, you know, looking back seem kind of strange today. But on a political note, I guess you would say, I think there are two big things specifically in Altneuland that that maybe Herzl wouldn't have liked. And I will see what you have to say about that. First of all, he was very against religious influence in politics, which we have a lot of in Israel. And second of all, I think he was, like a lot of Zionist writers in the decades soon after that, I think he was a lot more optimistic about Jewish-Arab relations than what actually has come to be.
So look, the gaps between his vision in the 1890s and early 1900s and what happened. By the way, one of the interesting things before I get to the core of your question that I noticed in the Zionist movement today is at the end, they had many of the leaders of the World Zionist Organization on the stage at the gala. And I was shocked, just as an observer, I'm not making a political comment, that two thirds of them were in kippot. And the Zionist movement that I grew up with in the 1970s and 80s was on the whole heavily secular and had the occasional kippah. But there really has been a change. And if that is a sign that the Zionist movement is more inclusive, great. If if it's a sign that the Zionist movement is now broaden religious Zionists and push out other Zionists, not so good. And I think that's the central issue in the state when you talk about the Jewish dimensions of the state. I think Theodor Herzl realized, it took him a while and he was on his own journey, that this Jewish state wasn't just going to be a state stripped of Judaism, and it wasn't just going to be a state of Jews. And there's a big debate about his first book, Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, whether you translate it as the state of the Jews or the Jewish state. I think he accepted the Jewishness of the state, but indeed, he certainly didn't want clerics dominating. And he was very, very upset by the heavy-handedness of the rabbis. In fact,
he wouldn't have voted for Shas or Yadut HaTorah, no?
No, certainly not in the election, not in the Zionist elections, not in the Israeli elections. He was supposed to have the conference in Munich, and he moved the conference from Munich to Basel, a very small city, but very charming, because both the Reform rabbis on one extreme and the ultra-Orthodox rabbis on the other extreme were so upset by Zionism, they were constantly fighting. The one thing they could agree on was no Zionism, no Herzl, no conference in our city. And to minimize some of the static, he moved it. So yes, he certainly would have a criticism of the some of the issues of church and state or religion and state in Israel today. And he would continue to be dreaming for a better approach with the Palestinians. But he'd love the Abraham Accords, very Herzlian, the Abraham Accords.
So a few months ago in the New York Times Magazine, there was a big article called, the headline was Inside the Unraveling of American Zionism. and spoke about a letter that had been signed by about 100 or so, I think like rabbinic leaders of mostly of progressive, pluralistic Jewish communities and synagogues in the United States, and comparing the Palestinian plight to Black Americans and things like that. But very, very negative when it comes to, when it came to Israel and about Zionism at large. And I think that, you know, we all hear and we all talk to people who, to some extent, feel that this even word Zionism is an evil word. It's a bad movement. It means Jewish occupation over Palestinians. It means all these negative connotations to it. Is that the case? Is there a way to reclaim Zionism to be the positive, aspirational movement, inspirational movement that it was?
For sure. I think that people from the left and from the right have to free themselves from what I call the occupation preoccupation. Not every conversation about Israel is about Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians. That was the great Arafat's move. That was the great Palestinian move to try to make it all about them. And I've spent the last 20 years talking about what I call identity Zionism, which is, you know, Theodor Herzl wanted us to go from philanthropic Zionism, which was just waiting for rich people like the Rothschilds to underwrite the small settlements that there were in Palestine in the 1880s, 1890s, to political Zionism. And political Zionism is, we need a state. Let's establish a state because we are a people. We have ties to a particular homeland, and that's to establish a state in that homeland, like today, 192 other countries in the United Nations. And so we succeeded. Of course, political Zionism still has work to do. We still have to perfect the state. We still have to fulfill the Zionist dream. And of course, have to occasionally defend the state. But we can't make the defense of the state, and we can't even make the political dimensions of Zionism freeze us from another part of Herzl's vision, which was, he said, Zionism is a return to Jewishness even before we get back to our homeland. And that return to Jewishness is a way into a conversation with American Jews, left and right, with British Jews, Australian Jews, French Jews, and Israeli Jews. And I think when I look at the world today, one of the things that scares me as a parent of four young children, I mean, they're in their 20s, which is young for me, but they're not babies, is I worry about their souls. I worry about their identity. I worry about their community. And I think because we live in Israel, I worry less than I would if they lived in the United States. And to me, identity Zionism is saying, we have this amazing asset. We have this 3,500-year-old conversation about values, about identity, about community, and you can be a part of it. And I think the Zionist movement has done itself a disservice by being too defensive on the right. It's done itself a disservice by being too offensive on the left and only focusing on the Palestinian agenda. I actually believe that if we could create this peoplehood platform and talk about what unites us and agree to agree, not just agree to disagree, then we'd actually disagree better and more in a more healthy and constructive way about the things that we need to hash out about Palestinians, about religion and state, about economic justice and all kinds of things. But the obsession with our problems and the obsession, especially with the Palestinian problem, distorts the conversation. Every time I say that, people go, yeah, yeah. And then they ask me, but what about the Palestinians? And what about the critics? And what about this? We've got to focus on identity Zionism.
No, so you bought me. Okay, I'm in, right? But The problem is, it's, I don't think it's just the Palestinians, but it's also the whole conversation today, even, what does it mean, even particularly within the Jewish people, is so partisan, it's so politicized, there's so much division. Is it even possible to reclaim that? I mean, to have that conversation that can unite in using Zionism kind of as this umbrella that would bring people together?
First of all, the Pew study shows that 83% of American Jews feel positively towards Israel. Unfortunately, many of our leaders, many of our rabbinic leaders, many of our professors, many of the people who write in the New York Times, many people who run the conversation formally are far to the left and far more dissatisfied with Israel, far more universalist, far less nationalist than most Jews. That's number one. Number two, there's this amazing movement called Birthright, and I have spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of Birthright students and participants over the years, and many of them come from nothing, many of them come sometimes from hostility, and when they come here, that 10-day gift, and they see that Israel isn't the Israel of CNN, and frankly, it's sometimes not the Israel of their rabbinic pulpits or of their professors or of even their Hillel professionals, they go, wow, how come I didn't know about this earlier? So I actually think we have a great asset in just our complexity and our truth and our reality. And 5 years ago, for the 70th anniversary, I came out with a book called The Zionist Ideas. And I said, I want to have a series of Zionist salons. I want to sit down with people left, right, religious, non-religious, sometimes together, sometimes separately, and have conversations about Zionism. And it's not about Bibi, and it's not about BDS, and it's not about the Palestinians. And before COVID, I had run informally over 200 such conversations. And people sometimes would ask tough questions about Bibi and BDS and Palestinians, but after we first talked about the fundamentals of Zionism, and I saw in people's eyes how excited they were. So I actually think we haven't done enough to build the identity Zionist platform, and we've spent too much time focusing on the critics and focusing on empowering the Peter Beinarts in the world of the world and the real harsh critics who get the headlines but don't really have the heart and soul of the Jewish people in mind.
I saw a lot of social media posts from young people at the conference. How do you feel the sort of future of, maybe not the future of Zionism, but the future of sort of diaspora Jews and their connection to Zionism? Did you feel from the conference and also just beyond that as someone who is, you know, a college professor, do you feel that there's a future to this? Do you feel that younger people are sort of waking up and trying to respond to the hate and the negativity that we do see every so often when we talk about conversations about Israel in campus spaces and other spaces?
So, you know, I'm not Mr. Happy Dappy. I was a little disappointed. There was there were 125 young entrepreneurs at a social entrepreneurship conference. I was more at the leadership side of the conference, and it skewed way too old for me. And I would have wanted to see even more young people there. But yes, I am an optimist when I look at the future in this way. First of all, there's a bit of a Herzlian jujitsu JEW going on, where I am speaking to more and more young people on university campuses saying, wait a minute, you know, I'm willing to criticize Israel, but I'm not willing to demonize Israel. And the obsessive attacks on Israel and putting Israel front and center all the time as part of the identity of progressives is creating a bit of a backlash, a bit of a rally around the flag effect. So, and we have to build on that to say, let's get again out of that politics and start talking also about other dimensions of the Israel conversation and the Zionist conversation. I'm a little more pessimistic when it comes to the fourth and fifth generation of American Jews like me. And I think many of those third, fourth, fifth generation Jews who've been so warmly embraced in America itself, our radar when it comes to sensing the enemies and seeing the enemies, especially from our left or from actually any of our partisan camps, have been somewhat neutralized. Have been somewhat disarmed by all the love we get, and by frankly now with all the discussion about Jewish privilege and white privilege, by all the guilt we get, and the sense of peoplehood is less intense. But here's the optimistic side, because Golda Meir said you can't be a Zionist and a pessimist, and Theodor Herzl certainly wasn't a pessimist either. Back when travel was a verb, before Corona, when I was at APAC Policy Conference, when I was at various Hillels, when I was meeting young American Jews, and I found American Jewish activists, often they had what I would call, because I have the name Gilad, so I can say it, weirdo names. Often they had Russian last names, they had Israeli last names, they had South American last names. And when they appeared to be, and I'm being obnoxious here, putting in quotation marks, you know, normal, when they sounded like a typical American Jew, but they were really passionate about Israel, often their parents were from South Africa or from Canada. What am I saying? That there's, in the American Jewish community itself, a growing number of young Jews who aren't boat people, and they have a bigger and deeper connection to peoplehood. They have a far better sense of radar and sense of fear when it comes to the totalitarianism of the left and the right, and a far better sense of fear and warning when it comes to the anti-Semitism embedded in their own natural allies, be it on the left and the right. And they're our future. They're the ones who are going to actually help us create a diaspora Israel partnership, which isn't just one side looking down at the other, which isn't just one side assuming the other is so fragile they're going to go away if they don't have our help, but is going to understand that the Jewish people together are stronger, and we have something to learn one from another.
Well, on that optimistic note, Gil, we'll say thank you for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Gil, listeners, you got to check out his books. He's one of the more prolific, probably, I would think even today, maybe the most prolific Zionist writer. Like every book has the word Zionism in it.
I want to take back the night.
So you want to check it out. And thanks for updating us on what happened in Basel. It was really interesting, and for kind of giving us the take on the future of Zionism. So thanks a lot, Gil.
Thank you.
Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Thank you for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast this week. We will be back next week as always. In the meantime, please give us a high rating on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoyed it, you can send it to your family and friends. We're available on all the major podcasting platforms.